Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 3. Of all of her cats, Callie considered David the nicest. Unlike Venus and Bernice, no one could apply the words fearful or flighty to his behavior. Unlike Howard, David explored, played, and generally behaved like a perfectly normal cat. In fact, David's normalcy so lifted her spirits after she found him under her back porch one rainy day, she went out and bought a new van with some of Uncle George's money shortly thereafter. Callie named her new cat after David Benkowski, whom she considered the nicest man God ever invented. David belonged to that group of animal lovers who work with animals because they enjoy all the qualities that make animals different from people. Add his parents' affluence and interest in worthy causes, and no one expressed any surprise when he left a lucrative private veterinary practice to become the director of the clinic where Callie worked. David and Callie began seeing each other, then sleeping together within 2 months of her arrival. As time went on, she told herself she loved him. When she asked herself why, she would list his many fine qualities, which she always summed up by saying, "A woman would have to be crazy not to love a man like that." As time went on, though, she couldn't decide whether she really loved him or merely loved the idea that loving him validated her sanity. After her parents' death, such validation became increasingly important to her, but it never completely erased the doubts in her mind. "It's not that I think I don't deserve someone nice," she tried to explain the problem to David the cat as he lay on her chest kneading her nightshirt after his namesake had gone. "It's just that, well, he's so nice sometimes, it bugs me." David purred and drooled profusely when she massaged him behind the ears, a slight imperfection that endeared him to her. Just as she was about to explain how living with such perfection might be a trial for someone whose early life maybe left her a minute bubble off plum, the phone rang. "Callie, it's Joe."
"Who?"
"Joe. Joe McDermott."
"Oh, hi."
"Yow!" She greeted him, then screamed in pain and surprise when one of David's kneading claws dug into her breast.
"Are you all right?"
Joe shouted with alarm.
"Yeah, I accidentally stuck myself with a knitting needle."
Callie pulled up her nightgown and examined the small dent in her areola.
"What can I do for you?"
"There was a message for you on your parents' answering machine."
Callie didn't even know her parents had an answering machine.
"No kidding. From whom?"
"Someone named Skippy St. Clair."
At first, the name meant nothing to Callie, but then she made the necessary connection.
"I think you mean Biffy St. Hilaire."
Warm memories flooded over her. She and Biffy had been friends in veterinary school, where they'd formed an unholy trinity with another student, Christian Osgood. She felt a pang of guilt that she hadn't kept in touch with them since graduation, and asked Joe to relay the message. She had a miscarriage, and Christian Osgood hung himself. He reported with just a little more clinical detachment than he intended, or she was prepared for at that particular moment.
"Did she say anything else?"
Callie almost pleaded as all her happy memories evaporated as suddenly as they'd materialized.
"Only that you could send a donation to the American Donkey and Mule Association in lieu of flowers for Christian."
Joe's remark surprised her. The last she'd heard, Christian worked with exotic birds. When did he switch to equines? Joe further contributed to the peculiar thought swirling in her mind when he added without missing a beat, "Are you going to need any wood this year?"
"Wood? Why would I need wood?"
she countered, looking out the window at the small scrap of desert her landlord referred to as a yard. "I didn't know if you planned to visit, and, if you did, how you planned to heat the house while you were here. I'm cutting some nice ash now, and if you want some, you can have it." Ash burns with a lovely flame and little ash, which may or may not explain its name. Only a fool would pass up ash.
"I'll take 10 cords, Callie declared, not wanting to appear foolish.
10 cords? What the hell are you going to do with 10 cords?
"It takes 5 cords to heat that place for a year. I thought I'd get 2 years' worth so I wouldn't have to worry about it."
It seemed perfectly logical to her.
"But you're not here."
"True, but I might be. And Billy can fire up the wood stove when he checks on the house." In addition to being practical, Joe McDermott also liked to take things at face value and had little patience with deep analysis. He also liked to define things clearly so he knew exactly where he stood or where he should stand. And he felt that same way about the people around him.
However, Callie reminded him of one of those crooked birches whose downward path he couldn't predict once he cut into it, no matter how hard he tried. And experience with trees, if not necessarily with Callie Shackelford, told him to put as much distance between himself and her as possible. "I don't want you to take this personally," he began, filled with a hope that she would take his remark very personally and tell him she no longer needed his services. "But you're weird, you know that?" "You going to sell me the wood or not?" she asked, her thoughts more on her dear friend than her caller. A brief silence followed, during which she wrote herself a reminder to look up the address of the American Donkey and Mule Association, and he envisioned a birch tree erratically plummeting toward him. Had he not needed the money, he would have told her to go to hell. As it was, he said, "I'll sell you the damn wood," and hung up. That night Callie dreamed that Gwendolyn tried to get into bed with her, but Venus, Bernice, Howard, and David wouldn't let her. The next morning she called her therapist to tell her about it, but Alicia had gone to Barbados for a psychotherapy convention. Callie felt her absence keenly because dream interpretation comprised the core of Alicia's therapeutic approach, and she had convinced Callie that major breakthroughs would come to her in this form. Unfortunately, when Callie began keeping a log of her dreams as advised, she discovered that many of them contained toilets. "That's because you have a poor self-image," explained Alicia, delicately smoothing her impeccably cut and colored tresses. "I want you to look in the mirror 3 times a day and tell yourself that you're perfect. If you do this religiously, I promise you'll have a breakthrough." 5 years had passed since Callie began talking to herself in the mirror, and she still dreamed about toilets and still suspected that this was her inner self's way of telling her that her life was going down that particular bathroom fixture. A dream about cats fighting over who got to sleep with her seemed like a breakthrough, and it depressed her that she had no one with whom to share it. After yet another day of relieving innocent quadrupeds of their reproductive organs, Callie didn't feel at all like going out for another nice evening with her nice boss and lover. A full moon hovered over the city and the pollution index was low enough that even asthmatic senior citizens ventured outdoors. On such a perfect night, she knew David would propose. "Will you marry me?" asked David, gazing lovingly into her eyes later that evening. Instantly, the massive logical computer that lived in her left brain ground out an extensive list of all of his desirable traits. "What a prize!" it screamed when it completed the job a millisecond later. "No, David, I can't," Callie replied, precisely mounding the shredded carrot and alfalfa sprouts that had fallen from her veggie wrap into a neat pile in the center of her plate. "But why not?" he implored her. "I love you, David, but..." "But what?" How could she tell him his perfection bugged her? She tried to come up with a reasonable lie, found nothing, and instead spewed out the first, unfortunately, irrational thought that occurred to her. "My best friend just hung himself, and he's not into birds anymore, and I have to send donkeys instead of flowers," she blurted, and then began to sob. The words made no sense, but the more she thought about Christian Osgood hanging himself, the harder she cried. "Oh, God, first my parents do a Halloween on me, and then Christian hangs himself," she sobbed into the veggie micro-monument on her plate. "Callie, Callie, darling," David murmured soothingly to no avail. "No, David, I've made up my mind. I'm going back to New Hampshire and do equine work." David's eyes widened in shock because Callie had never mentioned any interest in donkeys, mules, horses, or any other equines. She felt rather shocked herself because working on equines was the last thing she wanted to do. The words had just fallen out of her mouth, unsupported by any logical thought. However, once they did, she couldn't deny them because that would be crazy. It took David a month to find a replacement for Callie and for her to get ready to drive cross-country with the cats. Once he accepted that she'd made up her mind, he helped her put together a veterinary kit capable of treating any disaster that might befall the pets during their trip. He also held the most perfect farewell party in his perfect house, and they had perfect sex afterward. The next morning, he dropped her off at her place at precisely the right time, and they said goodbye. "This is for you," he announced, handing her a heavy object wrapped in designer paper tied with a raffia bow.
"Oh, David, this is your best emasculator,"
she squealed in mock delight when she opened it. Knowing that he watched her every move, she reverently examined the veterinary instrument that always reminded her of a hybrid bolt cutter. Instead of cutting bolts, though, the properly positioned instrument crushed the spermatic cord containing all the blood vessels and nerves supplying the testicles of larger animals, such as calves, while leaving the skin intact. Cut off from their blood supply, the testicles then atrophied. voila, a castrated animal. What the instrument lacked in sophistication, it made up for in efficiency. She gingerly slid it under the front seat of the van and thanked him profusely one last time. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.